Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, Bergen County. This is John Enslin. I'm a reporter for the Record, where I cover Bergen County government and politics for the paper. And I'm here to welcome you on this rain-soaked final day of September the 30th, to another edition of Record Talk Radio. This has been our ongoing series of conversations with journalists and newsmakers from throughout northern New Jersey. And today we've got a very special program. You might say it's a doubleheader, or as Ernie Banks would say, let's play two. We're going to have a conversation first with three of my colleagues who covered Pope Francis's visit to New York City and Philadelphia last week. And then we're going to turn the conversation over to Bob Klapisch, sports columnist for the paper, and also to Dave Kaplan, who is the program director for the Yogi Berra Museum. But at the moment, and just one program announcement, too. You folks who are listening, today is the last day of the Bergen County Book Drive. If you happen to be in Hackensack today, and you've got some gently used books that you want to give away, you can drop them off at the County Administration Building, 1 Bergen County Plaza in Hackensack, all day in the lobby today. They'll be going to homeless folks and to victims of domestic violence, so a worthy cause. But we have all three of our guests on the line today. We have Jeff Green, who covers the Passaic County towns of Clifton and Little Falls for the paper, and has been kind of the paper's point person for coverage of the Catholic Archdiocese of Newark. We also have on the line with us Stephanie Aiken, who's been with the Record since 2007. She's a general assignment reporter and has covered such varied topics as the fallout from the George Washington Bridge scandal and then the investigation, as well as the trial of a former Hackensack police chief who was accused of official misconduct. And rounding out our crew is Christopher Mack, who covers transportation issues for the paper and has also written for alternative weeklies, websites, national magazines, and newspapers. These three folks were part of a team that I thought did tremendous work last week in covering the Pope's visit, and I want to welcome all three of you to the program.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
All right. Well, since Jeff has to leave us a little bit early, I'm going to start with Jeff here. Jeff, tell me what it was like for you as a reporter to cover an event like this. Have you ever covered anything even remotely like it before? And what was it like, you know, being on the ground there and covering these crowds in New York and in Philadelphia?
Thanks, John, for having me on the program. I have never covered anything quite the scope of this in terms of an event that drew people in. I was lucky, I felt, because I actually didn't have credentials really for any of the different appearances that I was set to cover. I was at his mass at Madison Square Garden on Friday and then followed him down to Philadelphia for the Festival of Families and then his big papal mass on Sunday that drew probably more than 1 million people. I was just kind of floating around and finding people that were touched by the Pope and finding interesting storylines, meeting up with our people from Bergen County. I met with a parish group from Saddlebrook, St. Philip the Apostle, and also a large contingent, about 200 churchgoers from Ridgewood and Glen Rock. And I found it extremely interesting to hear some of the stories and how the Pope has impacted Catholics in really small ways. I wasn't finding so much that his messages of helping the poor and protecting the environment were resonating. I think that's what his priorities are. But really the tiny ways in which he shows, by example, through compassion and through humility, these things were really seeping into the consciousness of the people I spoke with. And I found that, across the board, everywhere I was at, and it was interesting to see that really play out.
Okay. Stephanie, you Tell us a bit about your role in the coverage, and what was the highlight for you of covering these events?
Well, compared to what Jeff and Chris were doing, I probably had kind of a minor role. I was there for 2 days on Thursday and Friday. On Thursday, I was covering the crowds outside St. Patrick's Cathedral, who gathered, you know, starting hours and hours, you know, 4 or 5 hours ahead of time, just to get a glimpse of the motorcade as it passed by. And nobody really knew where the motorcade would be traveling. So people were just guessing. And a lot of people were disappointed that day. And then on Friday, I was inside Madison Square Garden for the Mass. But, you know, even though, as I said on Thursday, a lot of people who showed up didn't actually get a glimpse of the Pope, I would say there was just a very celebratory mood all day long. People were just thrilled to be there. And as Jeff said, this is an event and a figure who's really touched a lot of people and who meant a lot to a lot of people. So it was kind of infectious just to be there. I personally am not Catholic, but to me, at the risk of offending anybody, I would say that it was kind of a similar energy to covering like the first day of legalized gay marriage in New York. Everybody was just so thrilled to be there and to be a part of it, and it meant so much to so many people's lives. So it was a great thing to cover as a reporter.
All right. Chris, you had an encounter with a person in Philadelphia that I kind of thought summed up a lot of the coverage. It was a great, just short little throwaway anecdote, but tell us about this fellow that you met on this bus shelter that, as you said, smelled of French fries, diesel smoke, and less pleasant things. Tell us about,
sure,
how you came about him.
Well, what was interesting was, you know, Jeff and I walked across the Benjamin Franklin Bridge, which took a lot longer than we were expecting. And so I was a little antsy to get started and to start meeting people. And about two blocks away from the press center in the convention center in downtown Philadelphia, I started talking to the first person I met was a woman in this bus shelter. And she had been waiting there for about 4 hours for hopefully the Pope to go by. There was a metal barricade set up in the street, barring people from going into the street from the sidewalk. And I had a sense, I didn't know exactly where the Pope was going to go, but I had a sense that the Pope was not going to be passing by this way. And I said that, and she and everybody else in the bus stop said, well, that's okay. We don't really want to fight the crowds, and they've got barricades, and hopefully he'll come this way. And it was immediately, and it was cold and windy, and I wrote the story very quickly, so I wasn't able to figure out a way to insert that. Immediately behind this nun's head, a man was playing an acoustic guitar through an amp very loudly. So it was just probably the worst place. Oh, it was terrible. It was just bad Jimi Hendrix covers, really loud, really cold. And it was just probably the most inhospitable place in downtown Philadelphia to not see the Pope.
Yeah.
And these
but
people,
you know,
were
what,
just
it kind of
doing everything they could.
She was there on faith. I mean, she just,
absolutely,
her faith compelled her to sit in that smelly bus shelter with the Jimi Hendrix guy.
On the chance that she would be able to get it to see him. And what she did see was the empty Pope mobile. The Pope was not in it. Go down the street for staging the parade that started a few blocks away. So that was what was really amazing about it was, and I agree with what Jeff and Stephanie said, just it was great to participate in something where you don't have to be ironic or jaundiced. You can go into a crowd not looking for the angle, just look to talk to people who are happy and joyous and interview them in a really kind of humble way about, let's talk about you being excited.
Jeff, you
know, if I could jump in
meeting
for a second.
Oh, go ahead.
There were many people who were just so thrilled to get, even the people who saw the Pope. I was with the 200 churchgoers from Ridgewood, and he just flew on by. But the excitement they had, even though he was there for all of 3 seconds within the views of their cell phones, they were just so, you know, enthusiastic and excited to see this man. And so it's amazing to see that kind of impact. And then the people who didn't see him, impact was equally as strong, if not even higher for some. So I found that to be very poignant.
Interesting. Jeff, I know you got to go in a moment, but tell us briefly about your encounter with Kristen Feeney, a woman from Edison that you ran into.
Yeah, so Kristen said that she had been raised Catholic. She went to Catholic schools, ended up at in a high school in Edison, and she eventually left the church because she's gay. And she felt that she was scarred by the priests in the Catholic Church who had said hurtful things to her, in her words. And she found herself in line at the, almost the very back, 11 blocks away from where the line really started at Madison Square Garden. And she was as excited as anyone to see Pope Francis. No longer a Catholic, identifies with the collegiate church in Manhattan, but she was inspired by the Pope's more welcoming tone. He famously said, "Who am I to judge?" when asked about a gay priest. So many people drawn in who are not Catholic, who don't identify with the Catholic theology, Episcopalians, many others who were just inspired by who they called a transformative leader.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thanks for, I knew you got to step off, but thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
All right. Stephanie, I'm curious, what kind of access did you have as a reporter to these events, and what was the security like surrounding them?
The first day on Thursday, I really had the same access as anybody who was standing in the crowd. I had a press pass, but it didn't really get me anywhere besides maybe to a Starbucks that was behind a police barricade. The second day, I had a press pass to the Madison Square Garden. The security was extremely tight. There were Secret Service officials and police, and we heard that there were undercover law enforcement officials in the crowd. So also just the whole mystery surrounding it was kind of interesting. Nobody really knew where the motorcade was going to be going, and that was I'm sure partly to protect the Pope. As a reporter, the second day when I had a press pass in Madison Square Garden, it was kind of interesting because they had all of the reporters show up 5 or 6 hours beforehand, and they bussed us the several blocks to Madison Square Garden and had us under very tight control. You know, all of our bags were sniffed by police dogs, and we had to have an escort if we were going to go to the bathroom. I haven't been to a lot of events that had such tight security. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's pretty tight. Chris, you had, I'm a Catholic myself, and you had one of my favorite anecdotes of the whole coverage. You ran across an extraordinary set of confessions being dispensed with at a place called Bar Madison. Can you tell us, in just about a minute or so that we've got left for this segment, can you tell us what you saw there?
It was really interesting. It was in the in an open kind of concourse at the back of Madison Square Garden, and bright. I mean, it was just daylight streaming in the windows, no screens, no privacy at all. And both the priests and the people who were confessing were fine with that. They just were there, and some of them seemed to be confessing really difficult things. Some of them were crying, and it was just all out in the open. And both sides, a priest and a confession giver, said, "This is how it should be. Giving one's confession and saying that I've sinned, and doing it out in the open is exactly what confession is all about." And so, far from being kind of surprising and shocking as I was as an outsider, they said, "No, this is how it should be."
Interesting. And, of course, one of the priests had one of the best lines because he'd been there quite a while, and he said, "What are they going to do, throw me out?"
Yeah, he was one of the concelebrants giving out communion, and he's like, "Well, they need me later, so."
Yeah, exactly. Well, Chris and Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing your observations about this fairly extraordinary set of stories, and great work, guys.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is John Insulin, and you are listening to Record Talk Radio our ongoing series of conversations with newsmakers and journalists from throughout northern New Jersey. That was a segment we just finished on the Pope's visit to New York and Philadelphia and Washington. And now we're going to turn our attention to the loss of a beloved and iconic figure, kind of two iconic figures today, the Pope and Yogi Berra, the great Yankee catcher. And here on the line with us right now is Bob Klapisch, my colleague from the Record. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, John. I appreciate it.
All right. Folks, Bob has been a columnist at the Record since 1996. He previously covered the baseball beats at the New York Daily News and the New York Post, and was also a player, so he knows the game inside out. Bob, I was thinking today, the story that our colleague did in today's paper on Yogi's funeral, Andy Vasquez, gave me a perfect segue from the first set of the first segment of this program to the second, when he said, or when he quoted Cardinal Dolan, who of course was spending a lot of time with the Pope last week. Cardinal Dolan said during the service, and this was unusual because he's comparing Yogi and the Pope, and he says, "Think about the two for a minute," the Cardinal said in his homily. "The smile, the face, the innate courtesy, the aw-shucks attitude, even the big ears, are they not similar?" There's a great way to tie two stories together, I guess. But, Bob, were you surprised to hear a cardinal comparing Yogi Berra to a pope?
Actually, I was not, because I've always found something extraordinary about Yogi. And I've been covering baseball for a million years, and I didn't cover Yogi as a player. I don't go that far back, but I covered him when he managed the Yankees in the 80s, and I knew him, you know, as the way he related to athletes, and he had this extraordinary gift for just bringing out the best in people. I mean, since 1984, since the year he did manage, I'd never heard anybody speak ill of him behind his back or off the record, and it's highly unusual to have that kind of track record in the major leagues, in a major league clubhouse, I should say. I mean, because it's a very political place. It can be often very cruel, very difficult. It can be polarizing. Somebody always has something nasty to say about somebody, particularly a manager, when the team doesn't win. And it was never the case with Yogi. I mean, he just had a way of unifying people. And I think, obviously, you could say the same thing about the Pope. I mean, he has this extraordinary ability to in a very divisive world, divided world, to bring us together. And Yogi did that in a sports venue. And time again, year after year, decade after decade, it wasn't a freak thing. It was just who he is. I mean, he was really a blessed figure.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're also joined on the line today by Dave Kaplan. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Dave is the founding director of the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center, which is located on the Montclair State Campus. He oversees public and educational programs there since the museum opened in 1998. And he, previous to that, worked as a reporter and editor at the New York Daily News and collaborated with Yogi on four books, including one of my favorite titles, When You Come to the Fork in the Road, Take It. Dave, welcome to the program, and condolences, because I know you saw quite a bit of Yogi at the museum. I think you told me once, he was a fairly regular visitor, was he not?
He was, and I appreciate the condolences, and please, it's not just for me, it's for everybody who has known him or who's been touched by him. I think it's a loss for us all, but we're very looking forward to keeping his legacy alive and being as vibrant as possible at the museum.
Mm-hmm. Has the museum seen a lot of traffic this week in the wake of Yogi's passing?
Yeah, it's actually been quite overwhelming, and we are having a public memorial this Sunday at the museum. We just had a meeting where we're planning a really great number of activities and events as part of that memorial, and so that will be open to the public this Sunday from 12 noon to 5.
Okay, great. Thanks for mentioning that. Bob, you know, sometimes lost in the cultural icon that Yogi was, because many people knew him for many different reasons, the museum being one, the advertisements, the classic advertisements being another. But then there was the baseball career. Could you talk a bit about what I consider a fairly extraordinary baseball career?
Well, I think most casual, even a casual fan, will know that, Yogi won 10 World Championship rings, which is an all-time record, which will never be reproduced, will never be caught, matched in any way. It's just no longer possible, and baseball isn't structured that way. No team gets to the World Series 10 times in one, in a single player's career anymore. The dynasties of the past are long gone. In fact, and Dave Kaplan can speak to this, is that Yogi used to tease Derek Jeter that Derek would never catch him. You know, no matter how hard he tried, no matter how great the teams of the Joe Torre era were, that he would just never catch him. Ten, I think that probably, to me, stands out more than anything, is what kind of champion Yogi was. I mean, he won more World Series than Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Mantle, DiMaggio. I mean, he's at the top of the list, and I think that, to me, stands alone what kind of pressure player he was. I mean, there were other things statistically about him. I mean, he hit 358 home runs. He never struck out. There was one year, I wrote it the year when I wrote a column about Yogi, the year that he struck out only 12 times in 597
wow.
at-bats, which is
it's unheard of.
Virtually impossible. It's almost statistically impossible to be a hitter of that caliber, to come to the plate that many times and strike out so infrequently. Apparently, he just could not throw a fastball by him. Again, I never saw Yogi play, but the research I've done, the people I've spoken to said he had an incredible eye for the ball. His bat speed was incredible, and he was fearless. He was just a really tough guy. I mean, as gentle as he was to people, he was an incredibly fierce competitor, and I think that part of it may be lost on younger fans.
Right. Dave, one thing I learned when I first came to your museum that I just never picked up on before was Yogi was a participant in D-Day in World War II. Can you tell our listeners a bit about that part of his life?
Sure. Well, there was a lot of people who didn't know that. And as a matter of fact, there were major leaguers during Yogi's career who didn't know that because Yogi was actually surprised one day. When people didn't know I was in the service. And I said, well, you weren't Yogi Berra then. He was really an 18-year-old kid, basically doing what people of his age did at that time. You enlisted, you got drafted, and you served. So he had just been signed by the Yankees. He had 1 year of professional ball. He was playing in the Class B league in Virginia, Piedmont League, enlisted in the Navy September 1943. And next thing you know, he had volunteered for kind of a secret mission, which was really a major part of the Normandy invasion. And so he was trained to be on a 36-foot craft called a rocket boat, in which they were providing cover for the GIs, the first wave of GIs to get to the beach. And he was shot at and firing, you know, providing the cover for the Allies to storm Normandy. And it was, you know, quite an experience. He recalled it in, you know, in different interviews through the years, but mm-hmm. and only Yogi would categorize it as, you know, when asked what it was like, it was like the 4th of July. he saw the flares, the explosions, and everything going overhead.
Right, right.
But, you know, he was a very religious man, and I said, were you scared? And he said, I just felt I was too young to die. And
mm-hmm.
he survived, thankfully, and, you know, it is a big part of his legacy, and I was so pleased to see that the Navy was well represented at his funeral.
Mm-hmm. Good. Bob, do you have any favorite Yogi memories? I mean, granted you didn't see him as a player, but I'm sure you ran into him once in a while.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, first of all, I covered him, as I said, back in the 80s. I covered him as a manager. And he always took a particular interest. I mean, the funny thing about this is that what I'm about to say has been repeated by, you know, scores, hundreds, thousands of people have ever met him. But Yogi had a way of making me feel like I was special to him. I mean,
really?
I felt like I was his son or grandson. He just had a liking for me. And again, he did that to everybody, which is part of his legacy. He just had that connection. Well, he had it with me because he was always amused that, you know, I played ball at Columbia, and I continued to play ball in the semi-pro league and in the Met League for Hackensack, and I just really never let go. I mean, I was never good enough to get drafted, but I was a fairly decent amateur player, and I just kept playing through my 20s and 30s into my 40s. And it was a source of great amusement for Yogi that I was still playing ball. And every time he saw me in the clubhouse, you know, as a manager and then into the 90s and when he comes for Old Timers Day, the first thing he would say to me, "You still playing, kid?" And he got such a chuckle out of it that I was actually still playing baseball. He wanted to know, "How are you throwing the ball? You still playing, kid? Come on, you're still playing, kid?" And, you know, as simple as a question as it was, it made me feel like I mattered to Yogi. And I understood firsthand why he was so special to everybody, because he did that for everyone. He made you feel like you were in his orbit, that you were special. And, you know, I'll cherish that forever. Just a simple question. Hey, kid, you still playing? I love it.
Right. I can remember that, too. That is so cool. Dave, how about you? Do you have any favorite Yogi memories?
Well, I've got too many to name, but my daughter, who is now out of college, just reminded me that, you know, when Yogi was at her bat mitzvah, you know, and he could have been more gracious. He was signing autographs for kids. Oh, man, because Carmen made him, but, you know, this big moment in my daughter's career. But then when he found out she played a high school sport, field hockey, he took it upon himself to find out how she did every single game. So he come into the museum the next day. He says, "Oh, she's Montclair one. That's good, you know." And
that's so cool.
And I mean, he cared about my daughter's high school career. I was just, but like Clapp says, it was just remarkable that he had this connection to people that was just unparalleled.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, gentlemen, we just have a few minutes left in the program. I'd like to ask you both to take about a minute to sum up what you think Yogi's legacy will be. And let's start with you, Bob.
Well, I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the program, I think for older fans who are still around and remember the Yankees from the 50s and 60s, they will remember Yogi as a Hall of Famer, as a 10-time world champion, and someone whose statistics in many ways will never be recreated or ever be matched again. For the generations after that, I think Yogi remembered as one of the great ambassadors the game has ever known, just a great human being whose legacy will obviously go beyond just the sport itself. He was just a gift to humanity. And I say that, you know, I don't say that lightly. It's not a cliche. He was a gift to all of us. And he'll be missed. You know, I think we were all sort of hoping this day wouldn't come. But knowing that, you know, Yogi was with us is our present that we'll take for the rest of our lives.
All right. Dave, likewise, we've just got about a minute left. If you could tell
us
what
I think I said it absolutely perfectly. You know, I always say he's different things to different people. You know, the older generation remembers him as this, you know, the cornerstone of the best, the greatest dynasty in the history of the game. And then for younger folks, you know, they've seen him as a pop culture icon and so forth. But I think his legacy will certainly be at our museum. And I say that because throughout his life, he's understood the game of baseball. He had a wonderful life through a kid's game. And he has spent all his 90 years just trying to inspire, help kids. And it's really what the museum is all about, to inspire and educate kids to be the best person they can be, to make good choices, and just to be someone of great character and integrity.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for your time. And, Dave, that reminds me, listeners, if you haven't been to the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center, you owe it to yourself to take a run over there. It's right on the Montclair University. It's a beautiful thing, and it's worth the trip. So, gentlemen, thank you both for your time today.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
All right. Folks, remember, stay tuned to NorthJersey.com and the Bergen Beat for all your Bergen County news, as well as tomorrow's Record. Talk to you later. So long.